It's a pleasure to welcome, making his debut on Torah in Motion, Rabbi Daniel Daniel Friedman, who is the senior rabbi at the Jewish Center of Pinac, and he's also a Magid Shir at TABC. Also, I believe, I don't even know, is that in Pinac? But that's where all the Pinac people go. I'm not sure. Torah Academy of Bergen County. He is a Magid Shir in the Beit Bedrash of Pinac. He teaches at Lamdeinu. He is studied in Yeshiva at Haaretz Yon, a graduate of Yeshiva University, and it's a pleasure to welcome here and to make a Shachayanu as we welcome him to Torah in Motion. Bakasha, Rabbi Friedman, it's all yours.
Okay, I want to just begin by thanking Rabbi Kelman for all of his hard work and the entire team at Torah in Motion. As Rabbi Kelman mentioned, it's my first time, so it's a real privilege as a host to be together with everybody. I understand that people join from all over. I actually recognize some faces from the New York metropolitan area, but I know people are from all over. So Bechol Makom Shehem, wherever people are coming from. One of the reasons that I specifically chose not to use source sheets is my first time in Torah in Motion, and I want to make sure that everything is really accessible to everybody, and that God willing, everybody will be able to benefit from our discussion of Parashas Chukas on an equal playing field. But of course, please feel free. They give us certain guidelines. But from my perspective, the more interactive, the better. People should ask questions. Certainly, if anything is not clear, what we're trying to develop. So what I really want to talk about this evening, with your permission, is the notion of change. I called the shiur the season's turn, because Parshas Chukas is really all about change and why change is difficult for us. Some of the benefits that come with change, but sometimes take a while to emerge. It doesn't often happen right away, but when it happens, it's profound and it's meaningful, and we learn something very important about ourselves. So let me take a step back, God willing, to take two steps forward. There was in the 19th century an illustrious Rosh Yeshiva by the name of Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, known as the Netziv. He was my grandfather's Rebbe. My grandfather's grandfather was a small town Rav in Europe, and he learned in a great yeshiva called the Yeshiva of Lajin, and his Rebbe was the Netziv. He had almost no possessions. My grandfather Zichron Levracha used to tell me, just my grandfather's yahrzeit, but he had a picture of the Netziv, and it was hanging in his study, which was also his living room, which was also the room where my grandfather slept. And the Netziv gave many, many, many shiurim at Volozhin. They had an unusual way of learning there, which is not what's typical in the yeshiva world today. They learned all of the masechtos of Shas. And he also said shiurim in the weekly parsha. They didn't have Zoom in Volozhin, so it wasn't, quote, Torah in Motion. But the shiurim that he said on the parsha were written up in a sefer which is studied all over the world today, called Ha'emek Davar. And he writes in his introduction to Sefer Bamidbar that in his judgment, this is always what the Netziv was interested in writing about in his introduction to the various Svarim, is why Chazal gave a sefer a certain nickname. So Sefer Bereishis is called Sefer HaYesharim by Chazal, the Book of the Upright, and he has an essay on that topic. And Sefer Shmos is uncreatively named the Sefer HaSheni, and he has an essay on that topic. And Sefer Bamidbar is called Chumash Pekudim, the census book. And the Netziv is very interested. He says, you know, there's so many very important things that happen in the Sefer. For example, the sin of the spies, the Chet HaMiraglim, and the rebellion of Korach. Counting is not so exciting. Okay, you know, maybe accountants will disagree, perhaps actuaries will disagree, but the Netziv assumes that counting is not so exciting. So why should the rabbis weren't accountants. So why should they call the book Chumash HaPikudim? That's his question. And what he answers based on a medrash, the Bereishis Rabbah, quotes a pasuk from the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, and it says, "Vayavdel Elokim bein ha'or uvein ha'choshech," that God distinguished between the light and the darkness, and the distinction between the light and the darkness is taken by the rabbis and the Bereishis Rabba to mean between the generation that left Egypt, this is the generation of the light, okay, and the generation of the darkness, that's the generation that would enter Israel. So those are not our associations. We think about entering Israel as a good thing. Like, why would that be the darkness? So the Netziv explains the following. He says, the generation that lived in the desert, so they lived in the light of the presence of God. They traveled with God. They experienced Sinai. They experienced Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea. They had a very intensive life of divine imminence, of Hashras, Hashrina, whereas the next generation experienced things in a very different way. Of course, there was providence, there was Hashkacha, but it took a much more refined microscope, if you will, to be able to perceive it. And the Netziv, in his introduction to Sefer Bamidbar, says, if you want to know where this occurs, you have to look in my interpretation in Parshas Chukas, because that's when the generations turn over, right? So smack in the middle of Parshas Chukas, indeed, is a 38-year gap, okay, where the Jewish people turn over generations, from the generation that left Egypt, that experienced the plagues, that experienced the splitting of the sea, that experienced revelation at Mamad Har Sinai, and then the generation, of course, that would enter the land of Israel. So Parshas Chukas, in an essential way, is about change and the nature of change, and we'll, God willing, have an opportunity to talk about that. But I have to begin, we don't intend to end, but I have to begin on something of a somber note, that change, in this case, is a little bit of a euphemism, because the change that we're talking about, by definition, implies the death of an entire generation. So part of what I mean by change is indeed the notion of a generation unfortunately passing in the desert, as was decreed back in Parsha Shlach in the wake of the sin of the spies. And there is a very fascinating structure to Parsha Chukas, which in many ways is dominated by the notion of death as essential for change. So maybe here I'll open it up. If somebody wants to be brave, be a Nachshon ben Aminadav of sorts, say, does anybody know in Halacha how we deal with death? Let's say somebody comes into contact with a dead body. So there's a process of tahara. There's a process of purification, which is essential. Like all processes of purification, it involves a mikvah at the end of the process, but there's something unique that happens actually twice before we get up to that final stage. Anybody know what that is? Just in broad strokes, what do we have to do? We don't have it anymore, but we will. It's referred to in the Chumash, v'haytala das b'nei Yisrael l'mishmeres, that it will be around if we don't have it. Anybody want to guess?
Are you talking about the Parah Aduma?
I sure am. Okay. Who was that? I have multiple boxes here.
My name is Annie Garmi.
Okay, Annie. Okay, Yashar Kuchef. Beautiful. So the Parah Aduma. So it happens to be that Parshas Chukas, which is all about death, begins with the antidote to death. Okay, the Parah Aduma is the only halachic section of Parshas Chukas, and then the entire rest of the Parsha is about dealing with this kind of change when there is the demise of individuals, the demise of great individuals. In this week's parsha, we have the death of Miriam. In this week's parsha, we have the death of Aaron HaKohen. In this week's parsha, we have the death sentence against Moshe Rabbeinu as well, even though that will take, of course, until the end of the Torah. And so we have a tradition that Hashem always gives us the refuah. He gives us the method, the antidote for healing before he gives us the makkah, before he gives us the pathology. So Parshas Chukas really follows that structure. So we have the Parah Aduma at the beginning of the Parsha, and I'll get into one of the details of the Parah Aduma in just a little bit, which is a halachic detail, but it's also very important symbolically and in Jewish thought, hashkafically as well. And then we'll sort of go through the pattern of change that we see. So as I mentioned, generally speaking, when it comes to the process of Tara, what's required is a mikvah to go into collected rainwater, what the Torah refers to in Sefer Vayikra as a bor mikveh mayim, where the waters have been gathered together by natural means. It can't be drawn by human force. That's a psul of mayim sheuvim. But there is basically one exception to that rule with three different applications, where the Torah requires not a mikvah, but does anybody happen to know what the other way of achieving purity, of achieving tahara might be? Not a mikvah, but it actually comes in the very same verse back in Sefer Vayikra. Very important for understanding our parsha. What is the alternative to a mikvah in halacha to become pure? So the
possible. An offering?
What's that? Is that Annie again?
An offering.
Okay, so an offering is very good. What you're saying is I don't even know if you know how profound it is. Okay, so an offering. So there is a category in halacha. There are four different individuals who fit into this category called the Mechusar Kippurim, or Yoledes, and Azav, Azava Mitzora. So that's a very interesting question, whether that offering is necessary for them to become Tahor, for them to become pure, or is it just necessary for them to be able to partake of Kodshim, of sacrifices? So Annie, what you're putting your finger on is a very, very deep issue. I don't know if we can resolve it right now in terms of figuring out what the nature of Mechusar Kippurim is, but you're saying something very important. So maybe if we do a halfway decent job, maybe I can come back to Torah in Motion and try to understand this issue that you've raised, what is the nature of Mechusar Kippurim. But what I was referring to is the Torah tells us that there is another way of achieving purity besides a mikvah, which is called a ma'ayan, a kinei natural spring waters. The Torah tells us, "Ach ma'ayan ubor mikveh mayim yetahor." So ma'ayan is fascinating because it's precisely the opposite of a mikvah. Mikvah is still collected waters. A ma'ayan, by definition, is zochalin. Zochalin means it's moving. A zochalin is an invalidation. It's a psul when it comes to a mikvah, but when it comes to a ma'ayan, it's actually definitional. And so the Torah says that when you're dealing with death or things that are like death, things like a saras or a zav, those are the three areas in halacha that require a natural spring water, where the Torah refers to here as mayim chayim el kali. So it's a fascinating thing that the antidote to death is the para aduma. Parshas Chukas is all about the death of a generation and its leaders, which we'll talk about. And Parshas Chukas begins with the antidote to death, which is Mayim Chayim, which is these waters of rejuvenation, these waters of life, these dynamic waters, which the Torah requires. It's absolutely essential for the process of purification, so that anybody who's come into contact with a dead body has to first come into contact with Mayim Chayim, with waters of rejuvenation, before they can become Tahor again. So that's something that hopefully we'll have a chance to think about, but hopefully that also gives us a little bit of an appreciation of what's happening in Parshas Chukas, why we have one halachic section at the beginning, because it's preparing us for the great change, for the demise of an entire generation, for all of the death that we're going to have to deal with. So as I mentioned, there is the death of the entire generation. Vayavo chol ha'idah midbar tzin b'chodesh harishon. So the Jewish people are now in the 40th year of the desert. So they're in the first month. And we have the death of Miriam HaNeviah. We have the death of one of the three great leaders of the Jewish people. And the early returns are not encouraging. Immediately following Miriam's death, the Jewish people begin to complain, as they had 40 years before, about the lack of water. They actually complained twice. Different occasions about the lack of water. The complaint is issued in such a way that it's very pejorative with respect to the leadership of Moshe and Aaron. And what follows, of course, very famously, is the tragedy of Mei Meriva, where something goes wrong. Nachmanides, the Rambans, refers to that something as a sod gadol misisrei haTorah, one of the great secrets of the Torah, because it's really hard to figure out what exactly went wrong at Mei Meriva. If we have some time, I'd like to try to talk about it, but something goes wrong, and not only is Miriam no longer living, but Moshe and Aaron are told that they will not lead the Jewish people into the land of Israel. I see wonderful comments, by the way, being posted in the chat. So as Nareen says, it's a different group of people complaining this time. That's exactly right. Right, that's the point. Indeed, it's a whole new generation of people, and yet it's a fascinating thing. Maybe Nareen, just to sort of raise your consciousness about it, that they formulate their complaints in a very provocative way. They say, "Why did you take us out of Egypt?" And Moshe and Aaron might say, "We didn't take you out of Egypt. We took your parents out of Egypt." And yet they still seem to complain the same way as the previous generations. That's a kind of a very good observation on your part. And if we have some time, maybe I'd like to come back to that as well. So, as I mentioned, Moshe and Aaron are sentenced to death. For Aaron, the death sentence happens virtually right away at a place called Hor Hahar. We're told that Aaron ascends the mountain with Moshe, with his son Elazar. Aaron merits seeing his crown, the Keser Kahuna, transferred to his son Elazar, and Aaron passes away there. And once again, the early returns do not seem to be encouraging. The first thing that happens in the wake of the death of Aaron is the Jewish people are attacked. They're attacked for the first time, believe it or not, since going all the way back to Parshas Beshalach, the attack of Amalek. In fact, according to the rabbis, even though it's never referenced explicitly in the Torah, the rabbis claim that this Kenani Melech Arad who attacks the Jewish people in this case is also Amalek. Okay, that's Chazal's way of picking up on a very simple fact, which is that this is the first time the Jewish people have been attacked in 40 years. So Aaron dies, the Jewish people are attacked. And then the very next thing that happens is, since they already used up their complaints about water when Miriam passed away, so now they start complaining about food. You already complained about water, so you have to complain about food. Could have been in the other direction. They say, "V'nafshenu katzav alechem haklokel," that we cannot abide the man anymore. Anybody remember what the punishment for this was? A very unusual punishment with the Jewish people complaining in this fashion. So what does God send to cause even more death in the Jewish people? So the death of a generation, the death of Miriam, a death sentence against Moshe and Aaron, the death of Aaron. And now what causes even more death? What's the,
love.
What was that?
It's love.
Okay. All right. So you're definitely on the right track, because the first time the Jewish people complained about the man, so they were given slav, and slav, it became a source of their death. That's all the way back in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar.
Now it's snakes.
Yes, snakes. Who said that?
Annie.
Annie again. Okay. That's going to be a clean sweep for Annie. Okay. Well, wonderful.
I like this Parsha.
Okay. All right, Ben. Maybe you're being modest. Maybe it's every Parsha. I think that's my first time. In any event, it's the snakes, the venomous snakes in the Chashim HaSrafim. And they come and they, of course, attack the Jewish people. And the Torah tells us that many Jews died. Vayamos Amrav mi Israel. And so it's another fatal event. So, you know, if you're sort of keeping score to this point, you'd say, wow, you know, boy, did we really need that Parah Aduma, because there's like, you know, death and death and death and death and more death happening in Parshas Chukas. It's really, you know, a very depressing kind of a Parsha. And sort of if you stopped at that point, so I think that would be the perspective. And you would say that this is all, you know, very, very ominous indeed. This is a good, you know, point for us to zoom out for a minute, tarte mashma. So just to think a little bit about, you know, this not only as an isolated incident, but as something maybe important that the Torah is trying to teach us, which is that change is very hard. The loss of a figure of Miriam's stature, the loss of a figure of Aaron HaKohen's stature, these things are, of course, major setbacks, and one doesn't easily recover from these kinds of losses. And so perhaps we shouldn't be so surprised that the early returns are, of course, you know, very, very bleak. As we outline, the Jewish people thirsting, but not in just a physical sense. There appears to be an element of despair in the wake of the death of Aaron. Again, the attack from the outside. Chazal say that we lost our protective clouds, and Yanani HaKavod went away, and we became vulnerable to attack. And then the Jewish people, again, complaining about the man, connoting a sense of internal unhappiness or dissatisfaction. And perhaps that shouldn't be too great a surprise, given all the tumultuous change that's going on in the Jewish camp. But a deeper look at Parshas Chukas, which hopefully we'll be able to achieve in the time that we have together, I think reveals some very important lessons about change and how the challenge of change, which is real, which should not be diminished, which we do not seek to minimize or to diminish, but that the changes in Parshas Chukas are actually important and provide the Jewish people for an opportunity for real growth and development. And this has to be documented in a very thoroughgoing and comprehensive way. So with your permission, I'd like to go through a number of the incidents here to try to instantiate the idea that there's actually positive change development. Okay, so we mentioned before that the Jewish people thirsted for water after the death of Miriam. Now Chazal have a tradition, the rabbis have a tradition, which is recorded in the Talmud, that Miriam, in her personal merit, was responsible for the Jewish people having water in the desert. This is what we refer to as the Be'er Miriam. And one of the ways that Chazal like to amplify this idea is by saying, oh, you see, Miriam dies, and immediately the Jewish people, you know, they don't have water anymore. In a deeper sense, right, if we think about it, the major events of Miriam's life all surround water. Okay, so what would you say is the first, you know, major event of Miriam's life? Miriam appears on the scene in the Torah. In which context? How do we meet Miriam? We want to go all the way back.
Waiting for Pharaoh's daughter to rescue Moshe from
right.
The
yeah, beautiful. Okay, so Moshe's mother can't even look anymore. V'tasim basuf hasfasa yor v'titatzav achosem meirachok l'deyam ayasalo. So Miriam is standing there by the water as a girl of about 5 years old, so courageous, so brave. The Torah even refers to her as an alma, which is an older girl. Vatelech alma vatikra sem hayalad, and she's so filled with ingenuity and bravery and courage. Okay, so that's the initial appearance of Miriam. The second major appearance of Miriam is somewhat briefer, but it's very telling. Also by the waters. Which waters am I referring to now? No longer the Nile River, but
Reed Sea.
Right, exactly. The Yam Suf. Fatikach Miriam Hanavia Achos Aharon. She's referred to the only time in the Torah as Achos Aharon. Specifically in that context, as Atof Biadava Teitzenacho Anashem Achara Betukin Udin Kolos, that she led the Jewish women in song. And as Chazal comments, because they were so optimistic about what was going to happen. And the Talmud ties together these two stories and says that Miriam, right, never gave up hope that this child who was almost lost at the very beginning would be the redeemer of the Jewish people. So Miriam's always associated with water, including when she dies, right, the absence of water. So really the meaning of Miriam, if we think about it, is really the idea in a deeper sense of hope where all hope is lost, right? A very good way of capturing that is, you know, water in the desert. Everybody else looks around and sees barren desolation, and Miriam is able to find hope. So certainly the loss of that kind of a persona is going to be very difficult in the desert, because how can the Jewish people survive without the kind of perspective that Miriam was bringing to the table? That's something that's very important. But perhaps this week's parsha has a little bit of an answer to that question. And we know that, you know, when it comes to Yam Suf, the rabbis, Chazal, perceive that as the paradigmatic Neis Galoy. It's certainly the archetype of a revealed miracle. It's the greatest miracle maybe that ever occurred in Jewish history, in world history. Of course, it's followed by what we say every single day as part of our davening, Hayam, Yashir Moshe Israel, Hazos, Vayomru le'mor, Hashem Hashem kigo ga'as, husve rachvo ramavayam, as we know. Now, that almost verbatim expression, as Yashir Moshe v'nei Yisrael, actually appears for the second and only other time in the Torah, in our Sedra, but with a critical adjustment that will become the key for our thesis tonight. This is what we call not the Shiras Hayam, but the Shiras HaBe'er. The Pasuk says, as Yashir Yisrael, the Jewish people sang the following song, as Ashira Hazos, Ali Be'er Anula, that the well should rise up and answer us, Be'er Chafarua Sarim Karua Nidiveyam Bim Chokek Bim Mishanosam, that this was the well that was created by the leaders of the people. So it's very enigmatic what exactly this means. So the rabbis explain in a very beautiful way. The Jewish people were traversing between the Transjordan and the land of Israel. And there were Emori who were located there, who were in the way. In fact, we'll see at the end of the parsha, we'll talk about it in just a few minutes, that the Jewish people actually go to war against two of the great Amori kings, Sichon, and then subsequently Og, and the Jewish people achieve a great victory. But the Jewish people are going through a narrow mountain pass. And the pass is so narrow that in the telling of the Medrash Tanchuma cited by Rashi, that the soldiers on one end of the mountain pass could talk to the soldiers on the other peak. And there's a wadi, there's a valley in between, and the Jewish people are going to pass. And of course, they're sitting ducks for people, soldiers, with the advantage of topography, of heights, to, you know, rain down stones and arrows and completely annihilate them, and they'll be trapped. So what happened was is that just as the Jewish people were about to pass through, God takes these mountains and smashes them together. Okay, this is what the Agada says. The Amori soldiers are crushed to death. Then the mountains separate again, the Jewish people pass through, and they would have been none the wiser, except the well, when the well went down to bring the Jewish people water, sort of dug up, I don't want to be too ghoulish, I don't know how many people are still eating dinner, but okay, it dug up, let's call it some forensic evidence of the presence of the Amori soldiers who had been laying in ambush for the Jewish people. As Yashir Yisrael, as Hashira Hazos, and the Jewish people sang of their great salvation. They were about to be annihilated, and God caused this great miracle to happen. Now, what's so fascinating about this is not just the parallel of Az Yashir, but really two things. Just first, in terms of the nature of the miracle, as Chazal are telling us, and then what we see in terms of the development of the Jewish people. So, can anybody just, based on the way that I described it, or if you knew it from before my description, can anybody sort of just think creatively for a moment and appreciate how we're meant to understand this miracle as somehow in dialogue with the splitting of the sea? Okay, obviously a different part of the world. One is in Yamsuf, here is in the Transjordan. But what can we sort of say that is reminiscent just structurally between these two miracles?
Well, the Egyptians were swallowed up by the sea when the sea closed up, and now these people are being crushed by the mountains when the mountains close up.
Okay, you hit the nail on the head. Was that Annie again?
Yes.
Okay, all right. That's the hat trick now. I think Torah in Motion is a Canadian-based organization, so we can make hockey references. Okay, so it's a hat trick already for Annie. Okay, excellent. Right.
But
so,
it's a reverse order, I believe. It's a reverse order.
Okay, good. Who said that?
Hedda, Rudolph.
Okay, excellent. Hedda. Okay. Hi. Okay. We'll have to catch up. Okay, amazing. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So right. So there's a parallel, but an inversion. Okay, perfect. Now you got both ends, right? So what happens is in Yam Suf, right, something is one, and then it splits apart, right? And then it comes back together. So here you have something which is split apart, and then it comes together to the Jewish people's benefit, and then it splits apart again. Hedda, that's what you're talking about in terms of the inversion, right? That's what you meant?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Okay, perfect. Okay. So Annie was correct and Hedda was correct. Okay. So we both are meant to have this parallel, but also this distinction where the Jewish people could literally pass through and not know the difference, right? That could have never happened at Yam Suf, if you think about it, because you can't get across the sea unless it's floods. The Jewish people had to know something happened, and they were supposed to know something happened, because that was supposed to be a moment that generated a sense of deep faith by Yaminu Bashem Uvimosha Avdo. But this was meant to be a great salvation that could have happened in a totally clandestine fashion. As we spoke about at the beginning, the Nitziv's observation, the hashgacha, the providence, the imminence is still there, but you have to know what you're looking for. You have to look with a much finer microscope to be able to pick up on it. So now we're ready to take the next step. Who sings this time? Right? The first time, the first time, what do we have? Az Yashir Moshe Uvenei Yisrael. Right, the Jewish people are led in song by Moshe. There's an extensive Gemara which goes through the way that Moshe sang and the Jewish people answered, which has many halachic implications for how we say halal. But just take it for now that Moshe was leading the Jewish people in song. The Jewish people were somehow responding in one way or another to Moshe. Here, the Jewish people don't need anybody to, so to speak, lead them in song. As Yashir Yisrael es Hashira Hazos. So we mentioned, you know, it's very difficult to lose the kind of figures that the Jewish people are losing in Miriam and in Aaron, but what it creates is an opportunity for the Jewish people perhaps to take a greater degree of spiritual responsibility. We know that there's a responsibility when there's a Yeshua, when there's a salvation, that people have a responsibility of halal the hodah, of singing words of praise to God. In fact, there's a very celebrated passage in the Talmud, in Masechta Sanhedrin, which has to do with a later king named Chizkiyahu, who was saved from destruction at the hand of Sanherib, who was the emperor of Assyria. He conquered like the entire ancient Near East, and he almost conquered Yerushalayim, and Chizkiyahu davened very, very, very hard, and Sefer Melachim, you can look, and Yerushalayim was saved. There's a plague out of nowhere that destroys the Machana, the war camp of Sanherib. And the Talmud tells us that God wanted to make Chizkiyahu the Messiah. And Sancheirav would have been the embodiment of the eschatological villain of Gog, Gog u'Magog. Why did it not happen? Why was history stunted, so to speak? So the Talmud says, because Chizkiyahu lo amar shira, that Chizkiyahu did not live up to his spiritual responsibility of singing words of praise to God in his salvation. Okay, that's a very important passage in the Talmud for many reasons. But you can see here when the Jewish people came to the awareness, when their consciousness was raised, that they had been saved from slaughter at the hands of the Amori, that they took that responsibility. They didn't wait for Moshe, as Yashar Yisrael, as Ashira, as Os, Ali Be'er, and Ula. So the change of Parshas Chukas, which admittedly is very difficult and admittedly comes with great challenge, actually provides the Jewish people an opportunity for spiritual development. Perhaps let's give another example. We mentioned in the context of the death of Aaron HaKohen that the Jewish people were attacked by a mysterious enigmatic figure called the Kenani Melech Arad. So the Kenani Melech Arad, I mentioned before that the rabbis have an association that maybe it was like Amalek in disguise, because it's the first time the Jewish people have been attacked since that time. But okay, so whoever it is, the Kenani Melech Arad comes and attacks the Jewish people. In the rabbinic tradition, the Chazal say that the Jewish people are vulnerable to this attack because the protective clouds that existed in the merit of Aaron HaKohen, these protective clouds dissipated, and therefore the Jewish people could be invaded from the outside, as it were. King comes in, and anybody remember what happens initially? What is the Kenani Melech Arad? What is he successful in doing? Successful from his point of view?
He kills a lot of people.
I'm not sure if he kills a lot of people. I don't know. Maybe it's the Ramban assumes that he didn't, but. Okay, excellent. Who is that?
Rafael Alman.
Okay, Yashkoch or Rafael. Outstanding. So he Grand Theft Auto, as I like to say, he steals the Chevy. No, so he takes a lot of prisoners. So the Jewish people are in a crisis. This has never happened before. The Jewish people now have captives. Rashi famously says that it was only a shivcha achas ketana, but the Ramban says more kedarko pshuto shel mikra. So he says that indeed there were many captives that were taken. So does anybody recall what the response is? Does Moshe lead the Jewish people out to battle? Does Moshe cast a spell on the Kenani? What happens?
Moshe asked Kadosh Baruch Hu to help in Israel.
Okay, good. So that would be like a good suggestion as to what we would think would happen, right? Because that would be the pattern up until now, is that Moshe should daven, and the Jewish people should go to Moshe and say, Moshe, do something for us. But what happens instead? As a perfect setup. What happens instead?
The people make a vow to God.
Exactly. So what we have is Vayidar Yisrael Neder LaHashem VaYomari Metonti Tenes Amazebi Adi VeHacharam Tiasareihem. Excellent. So I think that was Noreen again. Okay. Beautifully done. So no, Moshe doesn't do anything. The Jewish people do something very bold. There's a big halachic discussion about whether it's permissible or not to take a neder, right? The pasuk says, "V'chisechta lindor." If we stop taking the darim, lo yevechachet. The Torah tells us in Parshas Kiseitzes. So there's a very big halachic discussion, dispute in the darim and daf tes between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda as the propriety of taking vows. Forget about keeping the vows. If you take them, you have to keep them. But should we be taking vows at all? So Tosus explains at the beginning of Masach Techulin on Daf Beis. So Tosus explains that it may depend on what the situation is. So Tosus says Shas Tzara Shiny, that if you're really in a crisis, so then you can, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures. Remember the story when Yaakov was between the fire and the frying pan, and when he's running away from Esav and he's about to go to Laban's house. It's a very difficult time in Yaakov's life. So Yaakov takes a neder. Vayidar Yaakov neder demor. When Yaakov says, "Im yelo kimi madi ushmarani baderech hazeh asher nochi olech, v'nasam li lechem lechol uveged lobosh," if God will take care of me, he doesn't have too many requests. He says, "I have bread to eat and I'll have clothes." Then of course, when I come back to this place, ve'even hazos yeh beis elokim v'chol asher titan li aser asrenu lach. So Tosus brings a proof from Yaakov and says, "That must be what's going on here, that the Jewish people were in terrible time of crisis." And they had to take a net there that if they were able to destroy this people, the way, let's say, Rashi understands, v'hacharamti esareihem, then we'll take all of the shlal, all of the spoils of the city, and it will become what we call cherme gavoa, will become like a status of consecrated items, will become a status of hektesh. So that's amazing, because it means that the Jewish people were in an eist tzara, they were in a time of distress. So instead of running to Moshe and saying, "Moshe, save us, Moshe, help us," the Jewish people took responsibility for themselves. So here, what have we documented? We've seen that in Parshas Chukas, for all of the challenge, the very real challenge of transition, what we see is both litova, in a good sense, when the Jewish people merited the salvation, they sang shira of their own accord. And when the Jewish people were be'est tzara, de profundus, mimamakim, when they were in dire straits, so Vayidar Yisrael Neder LaHashem VaYomar Im Naton Titenes Amaze Biadi VeHacharamti Esareihem. So the Jewish people are now demonstrating a far greater maturity than we had seen, certainly at earlier points in the Torah, to take a greater degree of responsibility for themselves within this framework. Maybe one of the ways that we can capture this is By noting two further incidents in the parsha. One of the fascinating elements of Parsha Chukas is that the Jewish people keep on getting no for an answer. So the Jewish people are looking to traverse through the Transjordan from east to west across the River Jordan into the land of Israel. So first, and they're moving from south to north, and they keep on getting no for an answer. So first they ask Edom, and Edom says no. And even though this is only alluded to in Sefer Dvarim, it's actually explicit in the Haftorah of this week's parsha, which comes from the 11th chapter of the book of Shoftim, the story of Yiftach HaGiladi, that then they asked the king of Moab for a rite of passage, and he said no. And then at the end of the parasha, they ask Sichon, and he doesn't even bother saying no. He just attacks the Jewish people, and the Jewish people have to defend themselves, and they are actually able to win a great victory. Now, if we follow the story very closely, so the first request, as I said, goes to Edom. Edom is in the southernmost part of the modern-day Jordan. If you're going from south to north, it goes Edom, Ammon, Moab. Edom, Moab, Ammon, in that order. Part of Ammon and Moab were conquered by Sichon and Og, so that becomes like sort of the order of these events. Initially, the Torah tells us that Moshe was the one that sent emissaries to Edom. And Edom responds, as I say, not in the affirmative, but in the negative. Edom says, Lo savor bi, pen bacherev etzei likrasecha. Don't you dare, and if you try to pass through the land, so we'll attack you. We'll be violent and aggressive with you. So when the response comes, it doesn't come from Moshe Rabbeinu. So we see in the Chumash that it says that Yisrael says to Edom, please let us go through. So they try, the Jewish people, they sort of take over the negotiations from Moshe Rabbeinu themselves. Ultimately, it's unsuccessful. The Torah tells us, Vayimain Edom, Vasesis Yisrael Avor Bigvulo, Vayet Yisrael Me'alav. So already within this one section of the Torah, Moshe personally begins negotiations, but in Medias Res, right in the middle of that, the Jewish people assert themselves and they take over the discussions as if, you know, they're ready to speak up for themselves. And it might seem like a subtle point, but it's actually instantiated in the final episode in the Parsha. As I mentioned, the Jewish people have a war with the two Amori kings, Sichon and subsequently Og. And that war is preceded by the Jewish people, as usual, asking for a rite of passage. But here, it doesn't even say that Moshe sent messengers. It says, Vayishlach Yisrael Malachim El Sichon Melech HaEmori, that the Jewish people took responsibility for themselves, that they're now going to be able to have this communication. Of course, Sichon is not willing to respond in the affirmative. But what we see here is growth and development on the part of the Jewish people. We saw it in the context of the Shira. We saw it in the context of the Neder, in the war against the Knani Melech Arad. We saw it sort of in the middle of the story of Edom, and then we see it as it concerns Sichon with respect to those negotiations. So I think at this point, what we could try to do is maybe take half a step back and reflect on one of the things that we've learned. So we've learned, I think, that the change is very difficult indeed. And the loss of Miriam, the loss of Aaron, are accompanied by a sense of loss and even despair, futility over the water, over the food, the Jewish people don't easily adapt. And at the same time, over time, what seems to transpire is that the Jewish people are given an opportunity for development, and they begin to assert themselves to the point where they demonstrate far greater independence in a variety of different ways. Both in terms of the Shira that they sang, in terms of the Neder that they took, the war that they waged, indeed, even for their national welfare in the context both of Edom Sichon as well. I think the broader message here is that change is exceedingly difficult. It's something that we all naturally resist. And at the same time, change is essential for development. When there's no instability, so to speak, in the system, when there's no what people in the business environment call disruption, when there's no disruption, so everything stays in stasis. And that's true in terms of spiritual development as well. When change happens, and sometimes it's not that we're going and looking for it, but it happens to us, so it engenders, it forces us to respond, to find new reservoirs of strength and resolve that were heretofore unknown, even to those who possess them. And I think it, in very broad measure, And that's what the story of Parshas Chukas is about. And with that, this gives me an opportunity to talk a little bit about the aforementioned Sod Gadol Misisrei HaTorah, the sin of Meriva, to share maybe five or six briefly, without getting into all of the argumentation, five or six perspectives as to what transpired, and to share a certain idea may resonate with the sort of the conceit of the shiur tonight. So we remember that Rashi has an idea that somehow what went wrong at Mei Meriva is that instead of speaking to the rock, Moshe hit the rock, and for whatever reason that's considered a qualitatively lesser miracle. The Ramban, Nachmanides isn't sure why. I confess I'm not sure why either, but Rashi thought that was like a qualitatively lesser miracle, that if you would only speak to the rock, that really would have been a much greater Kiddush Hashem. And the failure to do so warrants, you know, like very severe punishment. Okay, so that's the approach of Rashi. The approach, let's say, of Ibn Ezra is a little bit mystical, a little bit difficult to understand, but he says it has something to do with Moshe and Aaron sort of like losing their kavana, that they were on such a level that they should have been able to execute God's will with an absolutely unbroken kavana, and somehow they lost that, and they're being punished for that. The Rambam and the Mor Nevuchim, much to the Ramban's consternation, the Ramban strongly disapproves of this idea, but the Rambam says it's all about anger, it's all about kas, that Moshe Rabbeinu says, Shibuna Hamorim, listen, you rebellious ones, and that's why he's punished, and the Ramban has 10 reasons why he thinks that that's not true, but that would be like a third approach. The Ramban says, of all the approaches that he thinks are not correct, he says the best of the incorrect approaches, okay, the best of the incorrect approaches, is the approach of Rabbeinu Chananel, who says that they misspoke. They said, Amin Hasel Hazan Notzi Lachamayim, that shall we bring forth the water from you, leading the Jewish people to the erroneous idea that it was really Moshe and Aaron that were doing this, and that's what the Torah means. So it's Yan Lohemantabi Lahakti Sheni Lene Bnei Israel. The Ramban says that the real answer is that they hit the rock twice, and they could have done it once, they should have done it once, but twice somehow that reflected like some kind of a loss of faith or whatever it was. The Bravanel says none of the above are correct. The Bravanel says really, you know, this was just tax evasion, but Moshe was being punished for the Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies. Aaron was being punished for the golden calf, the Chet HaEgel, and the Ramban, the Bravanel brings 12 rayas. He has 12 proofs that he thinks all support his argument. Okay, now there's one other approach, which the Abravanel happens not to like. There are some good reasons the Abravanel doesn't like it, but I think it's important to consider within this framework. And that is based on a Medrash, as well as a passage in the Talmud Bavli, Gemara and Masech the Shabbos, that says that there was no sin at all. The reason that it's such, to quote the Ramban, is Sod Gadol Misisrei HaTorah, it's such a deep secret, it's a deep mystery, or as Churchill would have said, an enigma wrapped in a riddle, wrapped in a mystery. So the reason it is such a mystery is because nothing went wrong. There was no sin that was actually committed, but to capture the words of the Medrash, and this is echoed by the Gemara Masech the Shabbos, that Hashem said, how would it look if the entire Jewish people of the generation that left Egypt that they have to die in the desert, and somehow the leaders ride off scot-free and are able to go into the land of Israel. So the captain has to go down with the ship, and that's the end of the story. Okay, so if you take that approach, what emerges, I think, is of a piece with the broader thesis that we've tried to advance this evening. And maybe what Hashem is really suggesting is that what's needed is turning a new page for the Jewish people. I'm not just saying change for change's sake, but God saw that the leadership of Moshe and Aaron was in some sense, and I should say Miriam as well, Shlosha Parnasim Tovim Ha'ilam Yisrael, so let me revise. Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam were, let's say, remarkable, but in a certain sense, stifling the Jewish people from achieving what they needed to achieve, which is a greater degree of spiritual independence. And that there wasn't any terrible sin that happened at Mei Meriva, but Hashem says, Lo saviu esakal hazeh, ela aretz asher nishbati lahem, that this is no longer the right thing for this generation. A leader always exists for the benefit of the generation, not for his own benefit or her own benefit. It exists for the people. And what emerges in Parshas Chukas is that with time, not immediately, you know, the results are very negative. The Jewish people thirst for water. Miriam dies. They complain about the man when Aaron dies. But the Jewish people begin to emerge spiritually. They take responsibility for themselves. Be'ez Tzara, they give a neder and they fight a war against the Kanani Melech Harad. What a contrast it is to the previous war, the battle against Amalek when Moshe raised his hands, right? Where the Jewish people are now taking responsibility. The Jewish people sing a shira for themselves. They sing of Shabbach and Hodah to Hashem, Ali Ve'er and Ula. The Jewish people like take over the negotiations with Edom right in the middle, and the Jewish people from the very beginning take responsibility for the negotiations with Sichon Melech Ho'emori. If you recall, going back 3 weeks or so to Parshas Baloscha, we had a little bit of a foreshadowing of this. It was enigmatic figures by the name of Eldad and Medad. The only time they appear in the Chumash, and they it says Eldad u'Medad misnabim b'machane, that they were prophesizing in the camp, and Yoshua ben Nun is very distressed by this. He says Adoni Moshe kila'im, that he wants Moshe to incarcerate them. The Talmud suggests that maybe one of the reasons is because that they were saying that Moshe's leadership is coming to an end. All right, that's one of the three possibilities as to what the content of the nevuah was. But certainly Yoshua was aghast that here they are, you know, issuing prophecies and somehow usurping the role of Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe says something which I think in some ways comes to fruition, at least in part in Parshas Chukas. He says, Hamekanei atali, what are you, zealous on my behalf? Umi yitain kol am Hashem nevim, ki yitain Hashem esrucho aleihem. Would that it were that all the Jewish people would indeed be prophets, that God would rest his spirit upon them. I'm not here to stifle the Jewish people. I'm here to elevate the Jewish people. That was Moshe Rabbeinu's greatest hope. That was his aspiration. And if indeed it was the case that the Jewish people needed a less dominant form of leadership to be able to come into their own, so I think that in broad measure is what Parshas Chukas is about. It's a very fascinating thing. Moshe's successor, which we don't meet until Parshas Pinchas, is Yehoshua ben Nun. He's described in that section of the Torah when Moshe davens for his successor, Kel Elokei Aruchos Lechol Basar, Yivkod Ish Al Ha'eda. So he's described within that framework, Kach Lechos Yehoshua ben Nun Ish Asher Ruach Bo, a man of spirit. What does it mean? So Chazal say, Ish Asher Ruach Bo, that Yoshua's characteristic as a leader was not to tell people what to do, was not to be confrontational, but to meet people where they were. And in that regard and in that respect, to allow the Jewish people to manifest their natural strengths by meeting every single person where they were and allowing them to sort of grow into the best version of themselves possible. He was an enabler. He was a facilitator. Very different style of leadership than Moshe Rabbeinu, who laid down the law. The Chazal say about Moshe Rabbeinu, Yikov Hadine Sahar, that he tells you like it is and what it is, and he lays down the law. So Yoshua was Yachol Eilech Kineged Ruchol Shokolachas Rachas, a very different style of leadership. And I think therein you see by implication what was necessary for that generation, very different than what Moshe and by extension Aaron we're able to offer. So just at the risk of repetition, just to conclude, I think the story of Parshas Chukas is we have the refuah before the maka, we have the antidote, the para aduma, the mayim chayim, which is our response to all of the challenge that comes with loss, the loss of Miriam, the loss of Aaron, the loss of an entire generation, the sentence of death against Moshe Rabbeinu, and change is very difficult. Change is very difficult for all of us. It's something that we resist consciously and subconsciously, but when change comes, the truth is that very often it gives us an opportunity for growth that perhaps we didn't even realize was possible. And the Jewish people are able to demonstrate in Parshas Chukas that absent the enormous figures that were lost, the Miriam and the Aaron even the diminution of Moshe post the Gezerah of Mei Meribah, which may not have been for any specific sin, but simply because God realized that the Jewish people needed a leadership that would allow them to grow into their fuller selves, the Jewish people were able to achieve spiritual maturation that until this point had been inaccessible to them. And maybe that's a good reminder for us as well, that when we encounter change and we're compelled to deal with change, that through that adversity and only through that adversity, we're able to cultivate deeper and more profound measures of spiritual attainment. I want to thank Rabbi Kelman once again very much for the opportunity, and to say that it was a great pleasure to learn together with you this evening, and wish everybody a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you very much. By the way, if I'm not mistaken, you started by quoting. Hold on, Milton, you want to say something? Okay, I was just going to say, all right. I think then Nitziv himself gives that shot that Moshe, it wasn't the punishment, but new generation requires new types of leadership. And I think that the Meshach Chachma, I believe, as also a beautiful comment also by Aaron, that that when the Torah introduces the census of B'nai Levi, it mentions the death of Nadav and Avihu and Parshat B'mir. What's it doing in the middle of nowhere? What does that have to do with anything? And he says that was just a way to tell the Jewish people, don't think they all had to be punished, and Aaron wasn't punished. You think Aaron got away at the Chet Egel, nothing happened to him. That's not really true. He lost his two sons. I have to look that up again, but that was such a powerful comment. But I do believe that Nitziv also says what you said. But Yeshua Koach, thank you very much. And of course, the famous Medrash in Bereishit Rabbah, that Rav Meir, Tov Ma'od, and his Sefer says, Tov HaMavet, death is good, because without death, it can't have renewal and growth. It may be bad individually, but it's very necessary for the growth of the world. But anyways, Yeshua Koach. Okay, any other comments or questions? I'm happy to hear.
May I ask a question, Rabbi?
Vakasha, I'm sorry, I stood in your way. Go ahead, Vakasha.
Okay. No, I remember when you told us that last time about Aaron being punished. My question was, have you ever heard an interpretation that when Hashem told Moshe to gather Aaron, the Jewish people, and the staff, the staff, that he picked up the wrong staff, that he took Aaron's staff, and Aaron's staff was made of wood, and his staff was made of some kind of rare metal or sapphire, and that when he hit the waters, he made them impure because he hit them with wood. The waters, which were living waters, were now made impure. I heard that recently in a shir, but I didn't know where it was referenced from.
Rabbi, you want to comment?
Annie, was that you, Annie?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yes. Thank you again for all of your participation. I'm not aware of that. There may be such a medrash. I'm not familiar with that tradition.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I heard that that Moshe took the wrong stick. He should have taken the one that was in the Mishkan, the one that was with the almond, blooming almonds, and that was the stick that should have been taken. Have you heard that one?
So I'm not familiar with that medrash, but that's interesting. You're saying that he took the mateh that was associated with, let's say, with the plagues, and he should have used the matav of Aaron, Vayotzei Parah.
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a lot to think about there.
Yeah.
I of course, a lot of the Mefarshim use that as a question on Rashi. If God told Moshe to take the matav, how can you say, obviously he's supposed to use it, so what's wrong with hitting the rock? That's what some of the Mefarshim don't like Rashi's, you know, pshat. But anyway, okay. Anybody else? Akasha? Okay. If not, we'll wish you all good night. Laila Tov. My shir tomorrow morning. Everybody's invited. 9:35 on the Siddur. We'll finish up Hodul Hashem and start Mizmor Latoda. Please God. And then next week, of course, Rabbi Liebtag kicks off the week at 11:15 on Sunday morning. Is a series on Yirmiyahu. Next Thursday night, the Parsha Shir will be given by Rabbi Jared and Standig, who is the Skan Rosh Beit Midrash, the assistant head of the Beit Midrash of the Beit Midrash Zichron Tov in Toronto, Beit Midrash and, here in Toronto, that sort of used to be known as the Wayukola, but the official name is Beit Midrash, you know, Zichron Tov. So that's next Thursday night. Okay, we look forward to seeing you between then and now. Rabbi Friedman, thank you very much. And okay, a pleasure, and nice to meet you, and have you join the team of Torah Motion. So thank you for your illuminating words of Torah, and bringing out the, you know, a lot of more participation than we often get, sort of on the in the middle of the shiur. So yashar koach for that also. Okay, everybody, Laila Tov and Shabbat Shalom. We hope to see you soon, and please do.